I'm Dr. Dawn Gross. Welcome. This is Dying to Talk, a special four-part series on KALW dedicated to transforming the taboos surrounding death and dying. The fact that you're listening means you've already started the conversation. If you're just sitting down to dinner, consider staying tuned. The dinner table is one of the best places to have these conversations. And if you're in the car, having a quiet moment to consider what matters most, maybe just what the doctor ordered. If the thought of having these conversations makes you a little or very uncomfortable, you're not alone. I invite you to hang in there. Stay curious and listen with an open mind. I'm a medical doctor and a scientist, and for the last decade, my work and my passion has been caring for people with life-altering and life-threatening illnesses. Today, I am a member of the palliative care team at UCSF, and there I have the opportunity to support patients of all ages, talk with their families and with their doctors, to ensure that the care that matters is the only thing delivered. My work has given me a unique vantage point to appreciate not only how devastating life and death can be in the absence of talking, but even more importantly, how inspiring and profound life can be when we do talk. The difference these conversations can make is never more apparent than in a crisis, when our own health or the health of a person we love takes a turn for the worse and we're placed in the position of making life and death decisions. Even though the topic of this program was planned months in advance, it couldn't be more timely for me personally, as I just spent this past weekend supporting my own grandmother through this very process. And had I not understood the mechanics of how and why things work the way they work, I'm quite certain she would still be in the hospital receiving expert and well-intentioned care, though care that would not be consistent with her own goals. During tonight's program, we're going to take you behind the scenes of real medical emergencies. And while this well-oiled machine is built to save lives, it also has a very hard-to-reach off button. So get ready to discover how the machinery of medicine works and how to make certain it works the way you need. We'll begin where many medical emergencies begin, with a call to 911. Brian is a trained firefighter and emergency medical technician and has 26 years of experience as a first responder here in the Bay Area to 911 emergency calls. Brian, thank you for being here tonight.
Hello, Don, and thanks for having me.
The first point of medical contact for many people is the emergency room. Guiding us through the ER is Dr. Jennifer Brokaw, an emergency medicine physician with over 15 years of experience. Jennifer, it's wonderful to have you here tonight.
Wonderful to be here, Don.
So what happens after you or I have been evaluated and acutely treated by the emergency medical staff? If we don't die, we're either going to be sent home or we're going to be brought into or admitted to the hospital. The days of our own primary care doctor being able to care for us if we're in the hospital are, for the most part, gone. Marcus Welby is too busy seeing patients every 15 minutes to come to the hospital. And quite frankly, hospital care has become so complex, it requires its own special training. Dr. Shoshana Ungerleiter is just such a specialist. Shoshana, welcome. So grateful you can be with us tonight.
Thanks so much for having me.
Finally, if things become really dire, the intensive care unit is the place where life and death often meet. Dr. Jessica Nudig-Sitter practices critical care as well as palliative care at Highland Hospital in Oakland. She's also hard at work on her first book discussing the experiences of death and dying in our nation's hospitals and ICUs. Jessica, welcome.
So pleased to be here.
So, Brian, as we begin to reveal the machinery of medicine, I wonder if you can help us to see what a 911 call really looks like from your perspective. Can you walk us through a time when things went exactly as they were intended, and then we'll circle back to compare a different time when things got complicated?
Certainly. My responses start with a call to 911. At that point, two engines, an ambulance, and EMS supervisor are all dispatched, and we respond with red lights and sirens to the address. I remember one call where I was greeted at the door by a young woman who asked what we were doing there. I explained our dispatch, and from inside, someone screamed, "Come in, help, you have to do something." As we went in, we found a woman in the back. She didn't have any pulses and she wasn't breathing. The woman who had greeted us at the door said that she had cancer and was on home hospice and provided me with some paperwork, do not resuscitate document. When I showed that to the other gentleman, he understood. He hadn't been part of the conversation previously, but I was able to explain that these were the wishes and his call wasn't warranted.
And so you were able to then not only calm the family down, help reorient them to what the focus of care was, and then make sure that the patient themselves was comfortable?
That's correct.
Wonderful. And I'm sure the family ultimately really appreciated you and your team being with them during that time.
It's a difficult time.
So what happens if, say, the paperwork that the daughter at the door greeted you with can't be found or doesn't even exist? What do you do then?
Well, we have a responsibility to help. And so we would ask that person to help find the paperwork while we assess the patient. A patient like that that wasn't making their own pulses or breathing effectively, we would have to treat. And we would need to take that person probably off the bed and put them on the floor to help them out. All this time, the family's sometimes arguing. The tension in the room is very uncomfortable. It's a difficult work environment. We try to help the patients, but we're also there to help everyone. And it's difficult to do in those circumstances.
Where time is of the essence,
yeah.
So tension's running high. So how do you navigate that?
Well, we try to express that we need folks to give us a space to work. We'll begin doing chest compressions if those are needed, or respirations, but only basic life support. We wouldn't intubate somebody.
So intubating, putting them on a machine to help them breathe.
We would help a person breathe, but we wouldn't put a tube in them to assist with respirations. At that time, if there were two versions of the circumstance where one person was saying this person was requesting no resuscitation and another was insisting that something be done, we would make a contact to a base physician to help us navigate through from there.
And base physician is an emergency medical physician in our community, specifically at San Francisco General Hospital. Is that correct?
That's correct.
So, Jennifer Brokaw, as a physician, emergency medical physician who's been the base physician at San Francisco General Hospital, what's it like to get these calls and what's going through your head?
These calls are actually very frequent to the base physician, and they are among the most difficult things to handle as a base physician because, you know, clearly the medics often communicate that somebody is in extremis and at the extremes of age or in the advanced stages of an illness. They describe how they look. And it's very clear even from the descriptions that people are close to death. And when there's confusion about what's supposed to happen when that person is close to death and there's no paperwork or nobody who can say that they are the representative, the legal representative of that person and are designated by the person to make decisions for them, the default setting is to treat.
To treat. So just for a moment, let me name some of this paperwork. And for listeners who might have tuned into another KALW program on your legal rights last month, there was an explicit conversation about the Physician Order for Life-Sustaining Treatment, or PULSED form. And this is a form that gives people an opportunity to distinguish what kind of medical care they would want if they're not able to speak for themselves.
Right. So there are really three kinds of paperwork that you could have in the home. One would be a PULSED form, a physician's order for life-sustaining treatment, that is actually a medical order signed by a physician, and it's legally enforceable. So actually, you know, doing something above and beyond what's designated in the PULSED form would be illegal, unless, of course, the designated healthcare agent was there to override it. So that's a wrinkle that we can go back to. Another form that is common is a pre-hospital DNR form, meaning that the person has designated that should they have some cardiac arrest or life-threatening event outside the hospital, they would not want CPR. And the third kind of document that most people should have is an advanced healthcare directive. And those generally are completed well in advance of illness. And at its most simple, is really just the designation of a healthcare agent or somebody to speak for you if you are unable to speak for yourself. But there's also the opportunity to make some statement about what level of care you would want to receive in a medical emergency and what you would want done with your remains.
Got it. So, and as I understand it, Brian, as an EMT, you're trained specifically to look for these documents, specifically the pulsed form in a person's home when you enter. Can you talk about what that process is like?
Well, it goes two ways. There are people that have the form readily available, and we also have the pre-hospital DNR do not resuscitate forms. We get those in equal numbers. And when we get the form, then we have to assess it, see that it's filled out correctly. There can't be any modifications to it. That disqualifies it as well. And if there are two forms, we need to check the dates and see which the most recent one is and follow that direction.
So emphasizing the point, or what I'm hearing, is the forms may not be sufficient, especially if they don't have the same information, or one was done years earlier and one was done later. And sometimes if we don't pay attention to that, you're going to get caught in the middle.
Yeah, but primarily making sure that they're available. Often we hear about a form that a person can't provide.
Yeah. So say this person then can't find the form, or there was never a form created. And Brian's team from the emergency medical technician side, the firefighter side, ends up touching base with you, Jennifer, as the emergency medicine base physician. And since we don't know what else to do, you bring them into the hospital and they come into your emergency room.
Mm-hmm.
What do you do next?
Well, the first thing we do is look in their medical record online and within our hospital system to see if we can identify who this patient is and where they are in their life cycle, and see if they've had a DNR. If we can't find any evidence that they have been designated DNR, it's a full code situation.
And a full code, just for those who may not know, is kind of what you see on television, where we get all excited in the hospital. Lots of people come running in. Big machines often get pulled out. We listen to people's hearts with machines. We look at what it's doing, and we can get pretty aggressive in that time. I want to remind our listeners that you're listening to Dying to Talk, a special KALW series aimed at transforming the taboos around death. I'm Dr. Dawn Gross, specialist in hospice and palliative care. In this second episode, we're talking about what makes the machinery of medicine tick and how we make sure its many parts are working for us and not inadvertently against our wishes. Joining me in studio are four experts in the different cogs of this medical machine, each of which have unique experiences to share and discuss with you. Brian Rubenstein has worked as a firefighter and an emergency first responder for 26 years. Dr. Jennifer Brokaw is trained in emergency medicine and patient advocacy. Dr. Shoshana Ungerleiter practices hospital medicine here in San Francisco. And Dr. Jessica Nudig-Zitter is both critical care and palliative care trained and practices at Highland Hospital in Oakland. We'll be back after this. Welcome back. I do want to let our listeners know that although I and my guests are medical professionals, the information provided in Dying to Talk is not intended to substitute for professional medical advice. So if we have a medical crisis, either your own or someone you love, and realized you hadn't done the thinking or the talking you need to, we want to hear from you. Join our conversation. You can call toll-free at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. Or you can email us at dawn@dyingtotalkradio.com. That's dawn@dyingtotalkradio.com. Or feel free to post us on Facebook at Dying to Talk Radio or tweet us at Dying to Talk FM. So, Jennifer, again, we're back in the emergency room. You're now stabilizing this patient, but don't entirely know what their goals or their wishes are. What happens next?
Well, we know we're going to admit them to the hospital. So the next step is to either call the critical care team or the hospital medicine team down to admit the patient, get them out of the emergency room as quickly as possible.
Because it's not a comfortable place to be.
It's not. And it's a very, very stressful place for family, especially if there's some confusion or conflict about what should be happening.
There really isn't room to try and sit down and have conversations. It's far from the kitchen table.
That's right.
So, Shoshana, you get the call from the emergency room as the hospital medicine specialist. You walk into this room of a patient, a family. You know very little about them. Where do you begin?
As a doctor who cares for patients once they're admitted to the hospital, really having never met them before, most likely, it's really important for me to learn about their baseline level of function, their ability to interact, so I really know where we're starting from with treatment. And based on the situation, I try to give medical prognostic information based on whether they're likely to return to their baseline level of function, which unfortunately is often not the case. And once they're admitted to the hospital, the question then becomes, just because we can do more tests and procedures, does it always make sense to do them in the context of this individual patient?
So that's a really important point, and I want to pause there for a moment and go a little deeper. What does that mean, we can do more, and how do you think about should we?
Well, given that it's the year 2016 and we've come very far with medical science and technology, you know, there's always another test, another procedure we can do to dive deeper into a situation, and many times that's warranted. But in the case of a frail elderly patient, it really behooves us as the medical team to take a step back and say, does it really make sense for this person? Is this what they really want?
So I can tell you, as I mentioned earlier, my own grandmother was in this very situation just a few days ago. She's 96. She's incredibly independent. But would I call her healthy? Probably not. She has a heart that has given a lot throughout her life. It continues to, but it's also tired. And she has a set of lungs that have also seen a lot of the world and are tired. And so when she feels uncomfortable, what happens? She got admitted to the hospital, not through 911, fortunately, but nonetheless admitted to the hospital. And the hospital started off by doing things immediately that made her feel better. And then the hospital saw other things they wanted to do, and it seemed like they had a hard time stepping back and seeing that bigger picture that you're talking about. So how do you do it, and how can you help your colleagues and families engage this medical system in doing just that?
Well, that brings up another really important point when we're talking about hospital medicine. Patients and their families should really advocate for themselves if they can, based on their personal situations and their value system. So asking questions of the doctors and the treatment team, like, what's the plan of care here? What are the alternatives to this plan? And often having a close friend or a family member present, if at all possible, in the hospital to sort through this and make sure that everyone's on the same page with the treatment team is very important.
So I can appreciate all of us sitting here in studio right now. We're very familiar with the medical system and feel that we're in a position to advocate, as you said, to ask questions. Hey, what's the plan here? What's happening? And what would happen if this didn't go the way we expect, or we chose not to do that? But I wonder, for people not as well trained in this system, unfamiliar with the system, if it's intimidating, and how we can make it perhaps less so and more inviting. And I particularly wonder when we get to the intensive care unit, and Jessica, obviously this is your domain, when things get so technical and so intense, hence the name, how do we create the opportunity for people to do exactly what Shoshana is saying, to advocate?
I think there are several approaches. One is we hope that the doctors are going to be making every effort to connect with the family very early on in the situation. A lot of times we try to do that within 24 hours. Sometimes it takes longer. And I think the more frequent touch points we have in these kinds of situations where people are sort of either fast getting worse, fast getting better, or even staying the same on breathing machines, for example, we really need to be frequently communicating with the family. And sometimes, you know, the team is really busy and the family feels that they don't want to disturb the doctors, and the doctors are running in and out of the rooms, and it seems like asking for information might distract the doctors. And I think it's really important that people remember that they really have a right to the information and they actually really need the information. And I think giving your doctor that news, if you're feeling like you're not getting what you need, is important.
So what I'm hearing you say is push a pause button on medical care and say, time out. Can someone please help me understand that you really have permission to ask that and to use those questions to better understand what is happening, what's possible, and what we might really expect from the care that's being provided or could be provided?
Absolutely. Asking about the prognosis, the actual condition that brought them here, and what the treatment options and their benefits and burdens are really important things for you to understand.
So I have a question here from Tracy saying that many people, as I mentioned, are intimidated to make these decisions and will frequently even differ from what their primary physician is saying. So how can we help people become more comfortable approaching their doctor with their own ideas? Shoshana, I suspect in the hospital this happens a lot. Again, since you are new to this family, to this patient as a hospitalist, they don't know you, you don't know them. You're trying really hard to learn what do they want and then help the other physicians that are likely part of the care figure this out together. How do you support a family and a patient in advocating?
Sure. Oftentimes, you know, it's really helpful for me, if at all possible, to touch base with their primary care doctor, someone they've maybe known for many years and knows and potentially knows the family, and connect in that way. If I'm not able to, I really do my very best to take extra time and sit down with people, especially if it's a complicated situation or there's dissent in the family. And get to know these people so that we can together come up with a plan.
And I have to believe, I've certainly experienced it in my own practice, where doctors don't agree on what we're seeing. I see it in the intensive care unit. Jessica, I suspect you see that in the intensive care unit. I wonder if you see that in the emergency room, Jennifer, when you are debating whether or not to admit someone and you decide, do you ever feel like there's such disagreement and families then have the ability to step in and say what they want?
There isn't as much disagreement in the emergency room among the doctors. I mean, it's a very focused practice on stabilization and transfer out of the emergency room. But I think, you know, it's really important for every doctor at every stage, and I shouldn't just say doctors, even EMTs can have profound influences on families in how they talk to them. And I don't think there's ever, you know, it's never too late to say the right thing or to use the right language with families so that they begin to understand what's happening in the gentlest way possible. We have to remember that, you know, end of life and death is a very traumatic thing for a family to go through. So there are certain phrases that are taught to physicians. You as palliative care physicians know them better than I do, that can really help families get to where they need to be and therefore open the door for the doctors to get to where they need to be, which is, frankly, more honest with the family.
With what the medical condition is.
Yes, and what
doing.
The likely outcome is.
So we have four professionals here representing the medical continuum, from emergency medical technician, firefighter, 911 responder, emergency medicine doctor, specialist in the hospital, as well as ICU level of care. What questions do you have for them? You can call us here toll-free at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. Or you can email me at dawn@dyingtotalkradio.com. That's dawn@dyingtotalkradio.com. Or please post us on Facebook at Dying to Talk Radio or tweet us at Dying to Talk FM. We have an interesting question here from Mark in Illinois. And he shared that he and his wife impressively had conversations when they were young and well to become organ donors. And she suddenly passed away. And Mark shares how relieving it was to know what his wife wanted, because they had talked about this, not because they had anticipated her dying suddenly, but because they had, he was able to know he was honoring her wishes. And he knows that there are four other people out there that are living healthy lives because of what his wife was able to donate and he was able to honor. And he wants to know how doctors feel about organ donation and how that fits into our advanced care planning and end-of-life conversations. How important it is it for us to decide this up front as we think about our pulsed forms or our surrogate healthcare decision makers? Should this be part of the conversation? And if so, what do we do next? Who has thoughts? Because I imagine in the ICU, again, in my own training, that's often where it shows up. But it's kind of after the fact when you can't ask people and then you're left guessing. What do you think, Jessica, in the ICU?
Well, in the ICU, we're frequently talking with surrogate decision makers and family members because many of our patients, most of our patients, aren't able to talk to us. And so, like most of the medical decisions that they end up making, decisions about organ donation are also falling into the family, under the family purview. And I think it's really important and ideal that people have those kinds of conversations way upstream before they get to the ICU, because once the devastation of death and sadness and this trauma of an illness happens, it's a really difficult time for people to be thinking and talking about organ donation. They do it, but it can be very, very traumatic.
I think, this is Jennifer, I think that one thing that people should understand about organ donation is it's vitally important. I mean, there's a long list of you know, fairly young people who are in need of organs. I'm fully in support of organ donation as a program. People do need to understand that in order to be an organ donor, you have to be willing to be kept on life support perhaps longer, you know, after death to keep the organs well perfused. So I think that everyone should make that informed decision. And for some people, that is not that is in discordance with their wishes on how to die. So to make a fully informed decision, I think, about organ donation in advance, they need to understand that it necessitates intensive care for longer, not that the person on the machines is going to feel anything, but the family should also understand that being an organ donor is a gift and a little bit of a burden sometimes for the family who has to watch the person after they've died, sort of
suspended animation.
And it's not fair not to prepare people for that.
To know that that's part of the procedure. And I think that's a lot of what we're talking about in general tonight, is how do we let people in on knowing what to expect? What does it really look like? We have a comment here about how different CPR and shocking hearts and critical care medicine appears on television when people are still wearing makeup and in their nice clothes and they get a shock and then they wake up talking and are ready to go. And how do we help people understand that's just not how it looks in real life?
So that they did a study that showed that the survival rate on CPR on TV is like 65 to 70%.
75.
In real life, it's, 6% in the community, 6 to 10 at best, and 15 to 18% in the hospital.
And I will say that there are many conditions that we can make families aware of where in which the survival rate is even lower. People with metastatic cancer and multisystem organ failure or sepsis or what other types of conditions over the age of 65 are almost guaranteed not to benefit from those types of treatments.
Thank you, Jessica. Yeah, Brian.
I want to put in that bystander CPR is a good thing, and we want people to be trained and ready to respond. There are some cases where it's appropriate and effective.
Of course.
Absolutely, and we certainly don't want to give a misperception, as Brian astutely reminds us from the perspective of first responders and 911, that CPR does save lives. There's no question about it, and particularly when people are young and otherwise healthy, that is a real lifesaver and a gift, so we should all consider, if we haven't already, trained with our local Red Cross or CPR specialists.
Agreed.
I'd like to take a call from Ruth in El Cerrito.
Hi, it's Ruthann.
Hi, Ruthann.
I was wondering what happens in the event if someone has a pulse and it's readily visible in their home and 911 comes to their home and on the pulse it has a DNR on it. What do the trained medical folks do if somebody's would need a medical intervention and that they're told not to resuscitate? Do they just do nothing?
This is Brian. So having a post is an opportunity to explain what your wishes are. If you're able to communicate a desire, then we will treat you for that. And you can even be transported if it's not a critical intervention that is something that you've listed as not wanting on your post.
So, Ruthann, I think in answer to your question, we ideally want to think about what kind of care we want and ask the questions of our healthcare providers in advance of, when I'm asking you for this care, when I'm telling you this is what I want, tell me what it really looks like, and does this match what I think is going to happen in my life? Am I going to go back to the way I was? Am I going to be able to bounce back up and go out to dinner with my family tomorrow? Or is that not realistic? What does it really look like? So thank you so much, Ruthann, for calling in. You're listening to Dying to Talk, a special KALW series aimed at transforming the taboos around death. I'm Dr. Dawn Gross, specialist in hospice and palliative care. And in this second episode, we've been talking about what makes the machinery of medicine work. And how do we make sure it works in the way we want and not inadvertently in some other way? Joining me in the studio are my four experts who have been helping us understand these different cogs of this machine. Brian Rubenstein is a firefighter and emergency medical technician, first responder. Dr. Jennifer Brokaw is an emergency medicine physician. Dr. Shoshana Ungerleiter practices hospital medicine, and Dr. Jessica Nudig-Zitter is a critical care as well as a palliative care physician at Highlands Hospital in Oakland. We'll be right back after this. Welcome back. You're listening to Dying to Talk.
We're exploring what happens when you call 911, what happens if you get admitted through the emergency room, what happens when you're in the hospital, and what happens if you're admitted to the intensive care unit. Sometimes these things work perfectly and save our lives. And sometimes when we're already quite ill, these things can get in the way of us living a quality of life that's important to us. As you might have heard, our most recent caller, Ruth Ann, was asking about what happens if someone has a request to not be resuscitated, but 911 arrives at their home. And there's an important message we want to make sure all our listeners know, which is all of medical care is focused on making sure people are as comfortable as possible. Sometimes the interventions we do, we sacrifice comfort in the moment for the possibility of returning someone to health. And the challenge is, when is that sacrifice actually too much? So, Brian, if your team is brought into this situation and it's clear that this patient, this family, are scared of seeing their loved one in distress, but are also clear they're not trying to reverse a natural dying process, what can be done?
Well, thanks for asking. You know, we are there, of course, for the patient primarily, but the entire community. And sometimes an explanation of what's happening and how it relates to what their wishes were, as they are described to me on a do not resuscitate order or post, is helpful for folks. That's not to say that we don't provide supportive care and if needed, transport a person that's not in need of a resuscitation.
So we have a tweet here from Laura, and she says that, you know, it was a weighty decision for her mom when she declined what her doctors were offering. And even though her oncologist at a point later on advised hospice, she says that she felt regret for a while, as though she'd given up on the care that was possible. And I would love nothing more than to try and ease what distress I'm hearing from Laura and from what her family has experienced, and provide maybe an alternate experience of what care is possible. And Jessica, as someone who works with the extremes of technical care in the intensive care unit, as well as someone who works in the realm of palliative care, which is designed to refocus care to particularly highlight what is most important to someone in the time that they have left, tell me, how could you put someone at ease when they're saying, am I giving up? Am I giving up the care that's possible?
Well, there's so many things I can say, I hope, to put people at ease. I think if people really do have an informed understanding of their disease and of the benefits and burdens of the treatments available, and they decide that they really are ready to go with a more palliative approach and stop disease-focused cure, there is some evidence, number one, that for some conditions, in fact, patients who choose that palliative approach or hospice actually can live longer. Definitely data out there looking at large numbers of Medicare patients, and they certainly live with a significantly improved quality of life. So I don't think that thinking of that as giving up or even if necessarily shortening your life is warranted. And I really, you know, also think that maximizing quality of life is something that really is a profound positive outcome that a lot of people will benefit from.
So I'll interject again with my grandmother, just since it's so fresh, in that once she was feeling better because of the great medical care she received so quickly, she then immediately began to focus on her priority of, I want to be home in my own bed where I can actually rest. The hospital is a pretty terrible place to try and rest. We all know that. We're all nodding our heads in here. We have this machine that has its own time clock of, it's time to check vital signs, it's time to get blood, it's time to do tests, it's time to eat now, and it's time to get dressed, etc. And it's not the same for most people as the kind of time clock we keep in our own homes. And so wanting to consider that redirecting the focus of care is not the same as stopping care or doing less care. In fact, when we refocus care to align with what people want, it actually can be even more intense. It just happens to expand what's most important to someone, whatever that may be. And sometimes that might even be staying in the intensive care unit, can't it, Jessica?
Absolutely. And there are many situations for which that's completely appropriate. Obviously, in patients who want to continue fighting the disease and doing treatment-related approaches, but even for patients who really have decided that it's time to take a more palliative approach, a lot of times it is appropriate to stay in the intensive care unit to get more aggressive care for certain types of respiratory problems or other types of things that we can palliate better in the intensive care unit than out on the wards.
So I want to ask our listeners to consider, have you thought about when an emergency room visit is appropriate? When should it be avoided at all costs? What are the best ways to communicate your wishes with your family, your friends, and your healthcare provider, and the community around you, particularly if you're older and you're living alone? It may not just be nearby family that you have the luxury of reaching out to. If you have questions, please give us a call at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. You can also email us at dawn@dyingtotalkradio.com. That's dawn@dyingtotalkradio.com. Or post us at Facebook at Dying to Talk Radio or tweet us at Dying to Talk FM. So, knowing that sometimes people show up in the emergency room that it isn't going to be the best place for them to get the care that they actually want, how do you turn that around, Jennifer?
I tell a story about a family that I encountered in the emergency room when I was practicing at San Francisco General that I had seen, as it happened, a couple of times in a less acute area of the ER, where in other words, not where the resuscitations went on. And they had had a very lengthy conversation about their wishes for their very aged father who had had a stroke. And every time they told us not to put him in the ICU. And then one day he came back via ambulance with the paramedics giving him breaths with a mask. And the unit clerks in the ER were calling the ICU team to come down and put him on a breathing machine. And I recognized him and ran out to get his son in the waiting room, who I knew because I had treated him a couple of times. And I said, "You know that we're about to put him on the breathing machine, and you've always told me that that's not what you wanted." And he said, "Oh, doctor, I'm just so upset because my sister left for China on business 2 days ago, and I can't let him die while she's gone." So I don't know who thought of it. I'd like to take credit, but we ended up taking the phone in the resuscitation room, one of those twirly corded phones, and calling his sister on her cell phone in Beijing. And we got a perfect signal. And we put the phone, we stretched the phone up to the patient's ear and let them talk for about 5 minutes. And none of us understood what was being said, but the patient actually perked up. Got a better oxygenation and began crying. And then her brother, the son who was standing there, took the phone, talked to her. And then he handed the phone to me, and she told me, "I've said my goodbyes to my father, and our wishes remain. Please do not put him on the breathing machine." And So we did something very different. We dimmed the lights. We sent the ICU team away. We got blankets, and we left the son and his dying father alone. And when I left the resuscitation room, I was in tears. The ER nurses were in tears. And we all looked at each other and said, "Why haven't we done this before?" It's very difficult to accomplish. But
and yet, in reality, what was difficult wasn't technology, wasn't medicine. It was thinking of it and making it happen. And we have a comment here from Anne saying, you know, it's her soapbox. But it's exactly what you just said, Jennifer, that care never changes. The treatments do. And if we can stay focused on the care and not get caught up in the treatments, perhaps, then we will make sure this machinery of medicine stays aligned with what our wishes are. So, Jessica, do you have an example of this?
Well, I can think of so many examples of situations where we had conversation after conversation with people, and we were questioning whether or not their goals were in line with pursuing disease-related treatment or starting a more palliative approach. And in the many cases that I can remember where the family decided, after getting a lot of information and a conversation, that they were going to pursue more of a palliative approach, or the patient themselves was able to speak with us, there was – we would then launch into telling them all the things – we would have already been starting to tell all the things that we can do with palliative care and all the aggressive treatments and how positive it can be and all of the things that we are going to do for this patient now. And you see this look of fear and sadness, and are the doctors going to abandon me? Is care going to stop? Is treatment going to stop? And realizing that there's something else we can do, and people just perk up in a way that is so inspiring to me.
Yeah. I think that point is so important that, you know, I hate the term withdrawal of care, because withdrawing care, you're never withdrawing care. You're changing types of care that you're receiving, but it's never a withdrawal of care. And the example of the person who had a pulsed with DNR, the medics will provide care to the dying person. They won't do what they didn't want to be done, but they will do something, and they will, moreover, they'll help the family who's already grieving, quite frankly. And that's really what we have to acknowledge, is that in these critical medical situations, the grief process has already started. And
right.
It's just taking some different forms. And often that form is anger and sadness that gets expressed as, why aren't you doing more, or what can you do to prevent this horrible thing from happening? Because, you know, grieving people just can't bear the thought.
Shoshana, I imagine, again, you get caught in the middle of that. Someone's now being admitted. You're getting to know them quickly. Family is scared. Family is perhaps even angry because they don't know what's happening. And what are you going to do about it, Shoshana?
Gosh, well, it's always such a challenging situation to walk into, again, as a hospital-based doctor who doesn't know my patients, you know, ahead of time often. Really, it's trying to kind of meet families and patients where they are. So taking the extra minutes or even hours to sit down at the bedside, to talk with them as if they were my own, you know, close friends or even family members, and say, you know, this is what's going on here. You know, how can I help you through this situation? And it's definitely a challenge.
I think I want to make sure people understand that none of us work in isolation, and we're really fortunate to have team members, colleagues that aren't necessarily in this room this evening, but we have extraordinary nurses as well as social workers and case managers who can help navigate some of these emotions that get exaggerated, get heightened during crises moments, and that the goal ultimately is to take this step back, as you have said, Shoshana, to try and look at the bigger picture. And I often say something about taking the 10,000-foot view or the 20-year view and wondering, what are people going to remember about what happened here during this hospitalization? This becomes the legacy for the families that are around the bedside, that are supporting this patient. And how do we make sure that their experience is ultimately one of feeling heard, of feeling supported, of feeling acknowledged, and that the care, even if it doesn't provide the result we might want, that it always provides the care that we need. We have another email here from Joanne, who says she's concerned she's made the wrong decision not having her much older dad resuscitated. Oh, Joanne, I wish we could talk with you. I'm curious to understand what you're thinking when you say you think you've made the wrong decision to not have your father resuscitated, and what kinds of conversations you and your father might have had or maybe hadn't had that has you living with that question. I would love nothing more than to remove that distress that I'm hearing in your email. My hope is that when we are able to talk with the people around us, and most importantly, identify someone who can speak for us when we can't speak for ourselves, that they will feel empowered to know it gosh, if they were here, this is what they would say. If they could speak for themselves, this is what they would say. And I would love nothing more than to believe that your father and you were able to have that conversation and he was able to tell you, this is what I would want, so that you can have your own peace of mind. My guests for this hour have been Brian Rubenstein, a longtime EMT firefighter, emergency medicine and patient advocate physician, expert Dr. Jennifer Brokaw, hospitalist and visionary Dr. Shoshana Ungerleiter, and critical care and palliative medicine practitioner and soon-to-be author Dr. Jessica Nudick-Zitter. Thank you all so much for being here tonight and for committing your lives to preserving the quality of our own. And thanks to everyone who's either called, emailed, tweeted, or Facebooked us during the program tonight. It takes a lot of courage to want to approach these conversations, and to be willing to share that is a gift to everyone who's listening, and I'm honored and grateful for your willingness to participate. Dying to Talk is produced at the studios of KALW in San Francisco. Rosalie Atkinson is the in-studio producer, and Debbie Kennedy is at the controls. Matt Martin is the advising producer, and Ashley Ann Krigbaum created the promos. All of the music for Dying to Talk is by the Oakland-based band The Kill Banes. Our next episode of Dying to Talk will be at the same time on Thursday, March 10th, when we'll be talking about caregiving, how to give and receive care, and how to ask for what you need when everyone is in a time of need. To see a full listing of programs in the series and to find resources related to tonight's program, please visit kalw.org. And if you'd like to share this program with family and friends, it will be available for online listening in the next hour. I'm Dr. Dawn Gross, inviting you to be curious, ask questions, and never settle. Or, as a hospice patient once taught me, life is uncertain. Better eat dessert first. Shoshana, where are those cookies? Break them out! No one else in the world tonight. Don't know where you're going.